Cable News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You're listening to Cable News In Depth. I'm Hannah Francis. Today I'm joined by Donovan Scribes, award-winning writer, producer, and communications consultant based in Portland, Oregon. He's the curator and editor of the recent Portland Mercury's The Recent Portland Mercury Special Blackout Edition, a five-year retrospective on the murder of George Floyd and Portland's racial justice protests of 2020. He's also the creator of an accompanying exhibit currently at the Black Gallery in downtown Portland. Hi, Donovan. Thanks so much for being here.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Absolutely. So first, how did you start this project and what was the process of getting these folks together like?
Yeah, it really just being here in Portland and obviously seeing the protests unfold and the messaging coming from those 100 plus days start to get unwound before the first year was away from us. And definitely as we're getting into year three, four, and obviously five now, I just was frustrated with seeing how those narratives were getting lost around not just the police and defunding the police and those type of things, but just general respect around Black prosperity. And so I've been marinating on the fact that that five-year anniversary of George Floyd's murder was coming up. May 25th, 2025 is when he's murdered. That's not actually when the public became aware of his murder, but I just wanted to make sure that as we are coming into that anniversary, that we as a community had space to reflect on that, you know, because it was the largest global movement for Black lives in America's history and global history. So that shouldn't be just treated with some of the ways that we interact as community now, just with like throwing up posts and things like that. I wanted to make sure we got that weight of the moment. And so it really just came as me approaching the Portland Mercury, who I already had a relationship with and have been working for in different capacities in terms of writing. And I told them my idea and told them that what I really was seeing was not just to have one writer or two writers and have it just be centered on one voice. I wanted it to be kind of a chorus and Black voices to talk about 2020 and what it meant and what it meant for us 5 years later, and for it not to necessarily be all the same angles, but to be able to approach it from a myriad of different lenses so that when people did look back on this anniversary, that they got to hear from us unfiltered, and that's kind of where it all stemmed from. We moved from there.
So this moment, the 2020 protests, I think were, you know, an important continuation and evolution of this crucial racial justice movement, which you mentioned was the biggest in the world. I'm curious about what you see the role of that time and the role of this specific moment playing in the overall storyline of the racial justice movement.
Yeah, and when I say the largest, it's literally just the scale of the protests. What we got to remember, of course, Portland was one of the epicenters because of how long we continue to protest here in Portland, but this was everywhere. It was like Italy, it was France, It was in different countries throughout Africa. It was in Russia. It was in cities. It was in little towns and suburbs. Like, this was not an isolated thing by any means. And, one of the writers in Blackout, Lakeana Drury, he has a piece in there called Dreams in a Vase with No Water. And that piece is kind of him reflecting on a couple kids that he has worked with. And it's really just a story of taking them to a Zupans and the isolation of going to pick some flowers for these kids. But he's relating it to how kids are able to dream or not dream in this city and reflecting back on 2020. And anyways, he has a program called Word is Bond, where he just took the kids out to Ghana. And he was just posting it on Instagram yesterday. So he's going to meet the ambassadors out there in Ghana and sharing Blackout with them. And the ambassador was sharing that, for him, George Floyd was the first time that he had actually stepped out to go to any demonstration himself as an adult. And, that's really the type of things that I'm talking about ultimately, is that this was such a global movement to recognize that in America especially, Black people have been demonized and had our dreams obfuscated by policy, by culture, by those things intertwining. This felt like, for a moment at least, that we were recognizing that this has been a 400-year tradition in the country, and there's never been any point in the country where we've let go of that tradition. It's been an ongoing thing, and that's not to say that nothing has changed, because I don't believe in that. That doesn't give credit to the myriad and long list of people who have continued to make sure that that is not true. But what is true is that America has never let go of the foundational things that have kept Black people in the positions that we've been in this country, that make statistics around anything from education to housing to law enforcement interactions being deadly or leading to deadly outcomes, continue to be so high. And so in that, to me, Blackout is a part of that tradition, is that, part of how these stories, part of how these things are allowed to continue is by quieting the stories, changing the stories, changing the narrative around what actually happened. And that's why I wanted to make sure that there were 12 distinct voices inside of this piece, inside of Blackout. So there's 12 different essays and interviews where people can get a snapshot into how Black Portland felt at this anniversary point. Because otherwise it would have been, who knows where it would have been in terms of how our narrative would be held. And so I just wanted to make sure that wasn't lost. And especially at a time right now where we have, coming through our federal government, a purposeful obfuscating of our stories and silencing of our stories, it's even more important to make sure that those things don't get lost. Because what that movement is about is making sure that people are scared to even tell their stories as well.
Thank you. You also mentioned that you had very intentionally placed the stories in the order that they were. What was kind of the shape of the story that you're trying to create?
Yeah, I ultimately was just trying to create a narrative arc for people. So, like Devin Boss, his piece, Ghost Town, Fronting the Revolution, Devin and I, now for a couple of years, have worked on different projects together. I knew of Devin before I actually knew Devin through music, but he had kind of pivoted towards filmmaking. And before he was kind of on the filmmaking side, he was really stepping out in 2020 and helping front these different protests. And in particular, like, you know, he had been working with my partner before he and I started working together. And I just heard how heavy like 2020 had weighed on him. And, you know, as I got to know him a little bit more, just hearing how much this ultimately, like, he was compelled to go outside, not by anything other than just being a Black man raised here in Northeast Portland. And then he ended up finding himself at the front of these protests. And then also, you know, feeling erased in that same protest movement, and how those things kind of mirrored the exact feeling that, like, a lot of us, like, I'm born and raised here in Portland, fourth generation, and just kind of mirrored that feeling of being erased in our own neighborhoods, being erased in our own experiences, being erased in our own narratives. And that was something that was heavy, you know? And so I just wanted him to kick things off, to talk about those things, to remind people that this is rooted in a real human experience, you know, and there's real, like, human collateral on the other side of these things. And him being able to even, like, share that history and memory with people, I think is important. And, you know, it to me, it pairs so well with ultimately where Lakiana takes it, with talking about Black kids getting to dream in this city, you know, or not, and the different options that are available or not to Black kids, whether that's literally available to you or just silently, covertly told it's not available to you. And then that ultimately kind of dovetails well with what Chris Lambert was sharing in his piece of being a kid here in Northeast Portland and having his, you know, having shot a gun that led to him getting 18 years. Now, we can talk about if 18 years is the right amount of years. We could talk about prisons and if that's the right way to treat somebody when they've shot a gun. But nonetheless, he's talking about that reflection, you know, from his cell, you know, because he wrote the majority of that piece while he was locked up. And it then leads into what Jenny Moore was sharing with her piece about being a good villager. You know, she had such a different take on 2020, talking about being a mom. You know, she was pregnant when she wrote this piece, and she already had a three-year-old, but she had a three-year-old daughter and she was pregnant with the son. And so that kind of folded into this idea, because Chris was talking about how little he felt held by different people, and she's talking about how important it is to hold people, and hold our children and hold our mothers and our fathers, like, and how visceral it is at the end of the day that George Floyd, you know, as he's being murdered by a crowd of people, or not by a crowd of people, but in front of a crowd of people, and screaming out for his mother as a 44, 45 year old man, you know, in his last moments. And so I won't go through all of the different pieces in that way, but to me, even though everybody wasn't in the same room, the pieces fit well, and I kind of asked everybody to take on a slightly different piece of the pie, so that when it all was said and done, as you read through this magazine, it's not really just like, oh, I'm going to flip to this person and that person because that headline is interesting to me. It really is told like a book, like or like an album, like a front to back, each piece leads into the next piece. And, you know, I have my intro in there, and my outro is my essay Symbols Matter. And I reflect on ultimately that moment that so many of us have seen, the die-in on the Burnside Bridge and 10,000 plus people on that bridge. You know, that was pretty compelling to me, seeing that happening and watching it unfold on Facebook Live and think for a moment, like maybe people are actually starting to get this thing. Like maybe people are starting to get it on some level. I've been pretty pessimistic about that generally if people get it. But people will often talk about things are symbolic. Like that was just symbolic. It doesn't matter. But symbols, ultimately, they do matter. They play out in our lives every day. I have a line in there where I'm talking about, like, if I see somebody with a swastika, it's a symbol, and that lets me know a lot about that person very quickly. So, symbols do matter. It's just like, if things are only symbolic without action, then that's kind of where we get lost in the sauce is, if you're only throwing up a Black Lives Matter sign, or if you're only putting up a Facebook post, or if you're only saying things are important to you, but you're not practicing it in your everyday spirit, then that's where the things get lost. And I think that's how ultimately a narrative gets lost. And I think that's how we can dovetail from 2020, abolish the police, defunding the police being on the table, to 2021 in Portland and people for Portland being able to like say, no, actually, to support racial justice, we need 300 more police. To support racial justice, we need to be sweeping more people in Portland. To support racial justice, we need to be forcing more people into treatment, despite the fact that like things like Measure 110 were just getting stood up. And organizations, Black organizations especially, that have never had funding, or organizations that were able to start through that and actually do the things that were getting many, many more people into treatment, those things were being stood up actively at the same time. Those things were being obfuscated by narratives like a People for Portland. And so ultimately, People for Portland is a great demonstration of matching their symbols with their actions for the worse.
So, 5 years later, when we say abolish the police, what do we mean?
Yeah, ultimately, to me, abolition is a hopeful outlook on things. For me, I'm, like I said, I'm fourth generation Portland. I had spent a lot of my years in Northeast Portland, 42nd and Killingsworth, 42nd and Sumner. Then I was on 82nd, or just off of 82nd, but I was going to school in the suburbs, and at least for my middle and high school years. And so for my middle and high school years, I was not just going to school in the suburbs, but I was going to school in like the best school in the state, Oregon Episcopal School. And so like OES is like very wealthy, on acres in the West Hills. And the difference between going from like around 82nd to that school every day was like super palpable to me. It was kind of alienating in many ways, but one of the things that was like always kind of there's not like a heavy police presence around. Oh yes, there's also many amenities in the West Hills. There's many things that people have in terms of resource that's available to them. I had peers and friends even that had, for their summers, for example, like they were going to go fly their planes, and so it's a matter of resource versus my mom working overtime at TriMet, and to the detriment of her body, to keep me at that school with the hope that I would end up at a place that would allow me better opportunities than she had, and but the neighborhood we were in was not the neighborhood that I was going to school in. And 82nd had no shortage of police. It also had no shortage of poverty. I wouldn't place ourselves in that realm. We weren't impoverished. I would actually say I had a pretty middle class upbringing inside of it all. But when you look at the whole of the picture, it was pretty stark when I was a child going to school there and living where I lived. And today, it's still pretty stark if you go to 82nd and you go to the West Hills. And the way that law enforcement interacts in those different environments is pretty clear to me. And so when we're talking about abolition, to me, it's those kind of like mirrors of each other of like, how do you resource a community to not be harassed around race and poverty, essentially? And that we have those examples available to us in communities that are well-resourced. And those resources came by way of like very purposeful planning through years and years and traditions. And that, like, for example, like Oregon Episcopal School, that school was, excuse me, before it landed in the West Hills with its acres, it was on the same site that City Hall in Portland is today. Like, that shows kind of the ties of what legacies exist between certain places and what legacies don't exist in others. So I think, to me, abolition feels very practical in terms of all the things. I'd also say, like, for me, I have been a journalist. I don't practice anymore, though, like, it's still in my spirit. I've moved more into like essay writing and things like that. But I used to work with Lisa Loving being my editor at the Scanner. And I actually just wrote an essay for their 50th anniversary piece, talking about how I was reporting during like the height of the Black Lives Matter movement becoming. And during that time, I had a lot of different questions myself and spent a lot of my time investigating police in relation to me and to my community and where I would land with all of those things. And so, I spoke regularly to the Portland police at that time just for quotes and like clarification on things that they were putting out. I even did a ride along with the police at one point. And, even just with the Gresham police, I had even did a Q&A with them about what does this term gang related mean? And when do you use it or when do you not use it? Why do you even put it out there? What's your criteria? What's your rubric? And what produced from me just interviewing them is that they had no rubric. And so the rubric is whether you say something is gang related or you put out to the media that it's possibly gang related, you're putting out a dog whistle to so many people, and it's a purposeful dog whistle in my view of things. And so for me, I will say, like, abolition to me also didn't come by way of just like a whim. It was coming from real life experience, from being a journalist and just being a curious around these different data points that only kind of continue to lay you to a certain conclusion in my mind. And I think Max Smith's piece, For I See No Other Way, one I leave or I love the title of his essay, but that's exactly what his essay is in Blackout is talking about. I don't see another way. And he's kind of laying out the case for why. And in my, in my lens, it's kind of the case for like why this guy is blue too. But I'm willing to have conversation with people about those things because I will say myself, I didn't always see that the sky was blue on the case of abolition. So I think it's it definitely has a lot of things that people have questions around, and I think many of those questions are valid.
What does this anthology communicate about complacency, or I guess complicity?
Yeah, I think it's ultimately, to me, you got to stay vigilant. You have to like continue to be in movement with a level of purpose tied to these things. I think For me, like, obviously being in Skinnaman, like, Black life is not a trend, you know, it's not, but I think when I there's connectivity between all these different issues that are happening in the world. So whether it's, you know, what we're seeing with how the feds are responding to the Latino community in particular, but it's not just the Latino community when we're talking about ICE. But, you know, when we see those responses and similar responses to the protests or that have emerged from that, or we're seeing just different things on the world stage. I think it's important that people remain centered in the connectivity, but to also not move to the next thing based on the latest headline, if that makes sense. Like, because these things are not, none of these issues are trends. So if it's really about seeing the connectivity, then I applaud those things. If it's about staying for this is the latest thing that people are upset about, then I think those are things to question deeply, because ultimately, for there's a lot of Black folks out here that are not going to be in the streets and weren't in the streets in 2020, and you know, we're going to continue to like try and live our lives and survive and thrive here in Portland, Oregon, and the country. You know, there's a piece that I had to cut from my essay, and it was something that I had learned on Instagram coincidentally in 2020, and I had to go and verify if this is true because it sounded ridiculous when I first heard it. But Harriet Tubman was alive at the same time as Thomas Jefferson, and Harriet Tubman was alive at the same time as Ronald Reagan. Different time periods of those two figures' lives, but Harriet Tubman was alive for both of those people's lives. And then for me, what is even more ironic, and not in a funny way, is that Ronald Reagan would go on to like run on a platform of let's make America great again. And he won every single state, Oregon included, in his campaign. And so these traditions and timelines are not as far away even as we like to make a lot of things seem. They're not. You know, when we talk about the state of Oregon even being 150 years old, I've been saying, like, I'm fourth generation Portland. My great grandmother, she passed away at 94 years old. You know, so like these things are within reach for so many of us. And the we can get caught up in being like, this is just the way things are. But actually, things are just like constantly being created and refined in front of our eyes. And so it is important to remain diligent in these ways. And I guess for not just white folks, but all of us, we have to like continue checking ourselves and seeing if we're being a part of the systems that have been put in front of all of us. And the systems, like, sometimes are people like, fight the system. And I get where that comes from, but the system is just people. Like the system is us, all of us. And so we have to be aware of what governments and businesses are doing, of course, but we have to be aware of what we're doing and how we choose to show up or not, in terms of like how these systems continue to impact our general lives.
Thank you. Is there anything else that you'd like to add today?
Yeah, I think for me, with Blackout, this is a really a special moment for the city and the state to be able to look at what was really a hard time, and what's been so great is to see the level of celebration that communities being able to have around being able to share our stories. And you know, one of the things I'm most proud of too is that people are treating my intro ask in this seriously. You know, I ask people to sit with it front to back, read it piece by piece, and you know, this is not being treated like, oh, this headline matches my politics, so I'm going to go ahead and share it. I haven't read the thing. People are really sitting down and reading these words. And what I told people in this is that you can come back to these pieces. This is like a historic piece, and you can come back to it at any point and get something from it. And so that's, I'm really proud of that in a time where we are moving quickly and getting people to slow down and consider. And I think those things will have fruits that we'll have to continue to watch for as well. So I'm happy about that. And for me, this is not the end point for me in terms of investigating 2020. My next point is to make a book out and continue these conversations. And so I'll be looking forward to that and engaging with people further.
I'm looking forward to it too. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
You've been listening to an in-depth interview with Donovan Scribes, curator and editor of the Portland Mercury's recent Blackout edition. For KBOO News in Depth, I'm Hannah Francis.
To KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
Be sure to tune in to Radio Lost and Found. It's the show that puts the OO in KBOO.